Okay, you're on. You're on free. If you want to talk, I'm going to mute the microphones and you're going to be on the air. And then we'll respond by turning on our microphones. Okay?
Okay. Do you want to ask me a question?
Yeah. Free, you were asking earlier about, you were actually not asking, you were telling me about how you are someone who tries to access certain sites, and what are some of the experience you've been getting? There are sites for alternative media and stuff like that. So you just want to briefly talk about your ability to access the internet and how it's been stymied just with the current situation?
Sure. Well, first of all, people should realize that the internet was not invented by Al Gore. It was invented by the Pentagon. The Pentagon, pentagram, you can go off on that. That's a whole other subject. But anyway, I don't have the internet here at the house because I'm aware of that fact, but I do go on the internet. I've gone to the public library, anonymously. Well, maybe not because they have your library card, but I have gone out anonymously at my hemodialysis treatments Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And I have noticed, like, for example, in the olden days, I used to always go to David Icke's headline news. He commented on all the headlines, what's going on in the world. Can't get that anymore. Impossible. It's hard even to get the People's Voice, which is his new site where all kinds of progressive or alternative controversial truthers, like you were saying, Wizard, expose their facts or opinions or what have you. And basically, it's really hard to get anything that's Alex Jones. You can still get InfoWars, Prison Planet, and that's kind of strange because a lot of stuff you can't get. And if it even shows up, it takes forever. That little bar, blue bar, just like it's like paint drying. So basically, it's funny. The stuff on the right you can find, but the stuff really that's not right, that's not centrist or to call, I guess, leftist or progressive or what have you, alternative, you really can't get. And that's saddening. And that's, I one, don't have internet here at the house, even though I have a computer, because I've already had a visit by a Secret Service agent in the past, and I don't wish to have the same visitation in the future.
Okay. Well, Free, that brings up a whole topic of conversation that is kind of beyond, a little bit beyond net neutrality, but it's not unimportant. It's important.
Well,
for sure. However, Mitchell was going to address some of the issues you've been having with bandwidth and downloading the sites that are controversial and, you know, some of the access issues you've been having and how that might actually be happening more and more as a result of corporate consolidation. Okay, I'm going to get you off the air now and you can listen and we can talk later, okay?
I wanted to say one thing. Net neutrality is a terrible term. We got to come up with something better than that.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Thank you, Wizard. Bye-bye.
Bye, Free. Thanks so much for calling.
Thank you, Wizard. Bye-bye.
Net neutrality, many people have long criticized the whether or not net neutrality is a good name for it. And in fact, John Oliver, who used to be on The Daily Show and actually had now hosts a show of his own called Last Week Tonight on HBO, and has actually produced a very good 12-minute segment about network neutrality, where he actually suggests a name. Unfortunately, the name involves a word that I'm not allowed to say on the air, but if you were to go online, you can actually see the video that he actually produced where he actually suggests a name for replacing net neutrality, the term net neutrality, keeping the principle in play. But here's the thing. It is peculiar that at the risk of actually trying to turn this phone call into something like remote tech support, there are a number of ways by which content over the internet can be degraded, or can be access to it can't happen. It's possible that, for example, if an internet service provider, not just rather an internet service host that actually serves the content by which people can access, if that's not available online, then there's nothing anyone can do as far as whether or not the content can be retrieved. It is possible, if it turns out that the site has been archived, that you may be able to retrieve the content or what had been left of the content through a resource like the Internet Archive, online at archive.org, an attempt to try to archive the entirety of the history of the Internet, going back to when the Internet Archive was founded in 1995.
Oh, thank you. That's a really great site. Could you say that again, Mitchell?
Archive.org, the Internet Archive. It is an amazing resource. They've probably archived, I don't know, probably upwards of 20 or 30 billion different instances of pages on the web. And it's an invaluable resource if it turns out you want to find pages that have, where pages may have fallen into disuse, or when websites get redesigned and content may get deleted or thrown away. The Internet Archive is a great way to try to find stuff that had been out there that you thought, wait, didn't I see that in thus and such? And you can actually, if you happen to know the full URL, you can actually look up its history if it's there. And that's the thing here, is the Internet Archive, as extensive as it tries to be, is not always 100% regarding content. It is possible that they miss a lot. I mean, the internet is a big and always growing place. And trying to retrieve that content or have it available isn't always a guarantee. But it's as good a shot as any for trying to retrieve content if it turns out that it's that may be unavailable. But here's the thing about the Internet Archive. Its availability is due to no small extent to a neutral internet. And if the cartel, the AT&Ts, the Verizons, the Comcasts of the world, would be very loath to try to provide the equivalent of the nonprofit service that the Internet Archive provides and has provided almost for two decades now. And so that's an example of the kind of thing that's at stake here. Then we have at least some reasonably comprehensive attempt at a snapshot of the internet over 20 years, and that's an extraordinary opportunity for research or for rediscovering information or research that can also be done in fields outside of computers. I mean, we're discovering a lot of social scientists who are discovering how people are behaving or interacting and using the internet as the grist by which that communication can happen. And luckily, because a lot of those interactions are recorded, that kind of research can take place, and hopefully insights can be gleaned from that. The Internet Archive, like a number of resources along those lines, can provide that kind of way to retrieve back not only information that someone may have posted and maybe have lost, but also for being able to discover trends about how the internet had been back in the day. Hopefully we can fight to preserve that net neutrality so that the Internet Archive can preserve another 20 or more years of the digital communications that we use and luckily have had and hopefully don't take for granted.
Yes, and so we don't lose sense of our history mm-hmm. on the web. Our human markers on the web as well. I think we have another caller, Mitchell. Let me find out more about this person. And if you want to continue on the path we were on before we started the music.
Yes. Social media and consequences of inaction. Just to repeat the question that we had before the musical break at the top of the hour, the question had to do with how would the abolition or the effective abolition of net neutrality affect the social media networks, the Facebooks, the Twitters, the Tumblrs of the world, which a lot of people are using a lot of times as their preferred communications medium of choice, even outside of the internet. How would that affect? Well, one thing to actually keep in mind that always has to be remembered regarding the interaction about this, at least in the example, Tumblr recently got bought out by Yahoo, but all of these entities, as useful as they are and as generous as they've been, are still nonetheless private entities that operate on a profit model. The thing that's being sold is you, the user of these models, and in particular, your particular personal information that is gleaned from things you say, or other people you visit, or updates regarding your particular life or life history. If you recently, graduate from school, then that, bingo, that's a fact that can be gleaned about that. Okay, that fact can be sold to, people who might be, selling things for new grads. Or if you just got engaged to be married, voila, now suddenly they can sic that information, place that information on you, and sell that information to, practically the entire wedding industry, an $80 billion industry in the United States. And suddenly, they're apt to try to contact you on that score. So it's important to remember these are private entities who have a for-profit model, you are literally the product being served. You're not the buyer or the seller, because you're the item being served. That said, though, they are and have been pretty useful as far as communications details go. And understandably so, because they were built on a kind of on that same neutral playing field. The movie The Social Network is the archetypal example of a couple of guys in Cambridge, Massachusetts at Harvard create a website, and they basically have the technology and the resources to be able to create that website and see it take off. Not every website certainly takes off or becomes that kind of grand medium of communication. But the potential at least is there regarding a neutral internet platform. And it is certainly possible, as many people have done, to start a new one. And it is possible under a network neutrality platform. We've seen examples about this. A clone, or at least an attempted nonprofit clone of Facebook, is one called Diaspora, whose history has been kind of checkered, to be sure. But nonetheless, it's there, and you can download the code, and you can modify that, update that, or start a modification of your own. A clone of Twitter that has actually gained a lot of traction in the last couple of years since it was founded, app.net, app.net. It's basically a nonprofit clone of Twitter, but it also is a lot more flexible than Twitter in that people can not only post comments that are upwards of, I think their limit is 8,000 characters, whereas Twitter is limited to just 140. But nonetheless, they also provide platforms and advanced programming interfaces and ways to interact with it. And they basically provide a sandbox for further development and further technological information that Twitter, since it's they're trying to basically build this kind of nonprofit model, has for the most part closed down. They had been open for a good part of their early history until such time as they became popular and gained a toehold in the awareness and understanding of a lot of people's use of the internet. But they've closed a lot of that down as of late, and they're now striving. In fact, they're actually earlier this year had opened. They launched their IPO. They are now a business where they're now beholden to their stock price and their stock owners and investors. So, but app.net has been started as a kind of nonprofit clone, and they were able to raise the money to build that, and they are in a neutral platform that kind of thing can develop and hopefully grow and maybe develop into, who knows, the new kind of communications medium. The potential is there, at least, under a neutral platform of the internet.
Mitchell, you bring up a lot of different points about social media that I think is really interesting with regard to that neutrality. Mm-hmm. One is using it as a tool of organization and communication across various social networks that, like you said, sociologists and other scholars are attempting to dissect, the idea of big data and algorithms and so on, that this information is being culled in the internet. It's a great way of finding out about ourselves as human beings. But I want to know, and I'm sure the listeners want to know, how that might be impacted by, an internet that isn't so neutral. And also where Facebook, and social media type websites fall in the debate about net neutrality. Mm-hmm. The other question that I have, I'm kind of giving you a three-part question here, is, you talked about alternatives to Twitter and to Facebook, notably the app app.net and also Diaspora, which I've also heard about as an alternative to Facebook. That brings me to the idea of open source and how open source technology, the kind of technology that has enabled a certain level of innovation on the internet and sharing of information amongst developers and people who have a passion for this, how that might be impacted by a neutral internet. And then finally, we do have a caller who would like to comment. So it's up to you how you want to handle this. You want to take the caller?
Let's listen to the caller first.
All right. So let's get her on the line. Bray, I am putting you on the air. Okay.
Hi. Mitchell, I wanted to say that as someone who uses the internet on a daily basis, I use my phone or my computer, but more often times my phone now, for great lengths of time on the computer. When I go on the internet to check on friends and family, or if I'm interested in an article by someone who is not, or a company that is not really a company, but maybe a blogger or some type of alternative media, when I go there to get the information that's there, you know, there's only so many places you can visit online with the amount of time that you have. You know, I work. I take care of my kid, cook, clean the house, what have you. You know, I have only so much time. But when I sit down in front of the computer, I want to be able to go to the places that I want to go in any, you know, and have access to it without it taking a long time, like it sometimes does, and without having to pay anything additional. I feel like right now we're paying too much as it is to get the cable internet connection that we have, the only provider for our geographic location. And what I worry about, if net neutrality, if the internet is no longer neutral and people actually have to pay to get into what it is that they like to you know, which websites that they like to visit, and you know, is it? I almost feel like the corporations are banking on the fact that people have their favorites. They're going to go to those things. Now that we've been tracking where they've been going, now we can take all this information and data and craft some sort of package where we can make it kind of like cable, and maybe a combination of the cable and the phones, you know, landline phones, and make bills for everybody and make them pay for each thing in you know, line by line rather on the statements. And I'm so fearful of that happening. It's definitely not the direction that I feel it should go. I don't think that people should be charged for it. And it just seems like this issue should be in corporate media, on ABC, on CBS, on NBC, on PBS. And it's not given attention. And that frustrates me as well. How do we get it so that more people find out about this, so that they know it's such an issue, and do something about it? I mean, what can I do as a person? Because I have memories of how it was back in the cable days when we had to pay for cable, and I didn't like it. I mean, I watched one channel when I watched it. Why should I pay like $45 a month just to have one channel, you know, a couple hours a day at the most, or I'm sorry, a couple hours a week? It doesn't make sense. So you know, I just guess I would like you to explain how we can avoid this from ever happening and to keep the internet free so we don't have to pay for it. And I know companies are always working to do that. And how can it be, maybe you went over it with the policy changes, how can we get it so that it never comes up again and this is not a struggle that's going to be ongoing?
Good question. There were a lot of points that were raised there. I hope I do justice to trying to address a number of the points. Let me just address the immediate point here regarding what do we do to preserve net neutrality. We touched on this in the hour previous, but it bears mentioning again, so I will mention it again. At a minimum, comment on that docket. I can't emphasize that at once. So point one would be to go to...
That's fcc.org.
Gov.
FCC.gov.
.gov/comments. And you can, in fact, it is and probably will be for quite a while, the most commented docket. It's right there at the top. Follow the links. It'll take you to a form. Fill out that form and tell a story. That's actually the critical point here. Not just to basically say, you know, I want to keep net neutrality, even though that's useful and that'll be noted as a record, but to also make your comment as impactful as possible. And the way you do that is to not only comment, and specifically to comment on the particular request at issue, which is the reclassification of the internet to what we had termed as the Title II framework. That's actually the legal framework, as we mentioned last hour, where the internet had been under, where neutrality was enshrined in law, where it had been removed, and where there is now, I'm happy to report, it's mentioned as a policy option again, but that's because so many people commented about it. Comment on that docket. Comment on the docket in as articulately as possible. Tell the story not only about how, in fact, actually what the caller had mentioned. If you are, you know, you're a busy mom and you've got to take care of, you don't have a whole lot of time in your day and you've got like maybe an hour or two to try to gain as much information as you can on the world and the internet proves useful for you. That's a great story. Tell that story. Write it up and add it to the docket. That will not only be added to your list of comments so that not only does the FCC see it, but also anyone can visit the FCC's website and also see that comment. That is a docket, a public record. That means it's publicly accessible, and that is exactly why. And that can prove helpful not only later on for the core challenges that will come if it turns out that this kind of protection doesn't happen. And that can prove very handy in this score. And you never know how that can play out. We've seen that in the media ownership fight, in other fights in the media in the past. Those comments matter in ways you don't expect. So comment on the docket. Write as articulate a story about how the internet under a neutral platform affects you and impacts you. And also critically spread the word about this in every way you can. And using the internet has been a gold mine and a boon as far as that kind of outreach is concerned. Don't just limit it to that. I mean, in fact, that's been part and parcel of my own personal involvement regarding the media activism on this score going back, 12 years now. But it's basically being that I'm basically doing the societal equivalent of taking the body public and trying to get it to smelling salts. To like say, look, you've got to get out of your stupor. This is a serious issue, and you've got to get involved on this. And here's what you do on the score. And that's where we've had the wins, as meager as they've been thus far, regarding the internet. I mean, the like I said, the classification of the reclassification of the internet back into a neutral platform, the Title II framework, is back on the table. Why is that? Well, because more than 3 million people broke a record that activists had set a decade earlier. Where people are saying, we want to keep this internet as a neutral platform. We don't want, as the FCC had termed it, paid prioritization as an option, which would basically be the beginning of the end as far as the kind of neutral free framework that the internet has had. So, and that's what would be at stake here, in that, you know, it sucks that, you know, at least in my example, probably pay upwards of, I don't know, $80 a month in Chicago to get cable internet access in my home. That you could see that perhaps over time double to that level. And not only that, but it would also be where, yeah, if you want to access, you know, Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, okay, that's our social media tier. That's another $25 a month, please. Or if you wanted to access international news. I don't trust the American media, but I'm going to go to, you know, The Guardian of London or Le Monde in France or any of the international
France
media.
24.
Yeah. Or any of the international. I mean, I'll actually read, my family's from Poland. I read the Polish media. So I'll read international coverage. I'll read Just Popolita. Or I'll read actually a former Polish anarchist website called Poprostu, which actually is literally the Polish word for straight ahead. I'll read that, but that's, you know, international coverage, and I'll be able to see that. So that, and it's like the fact that I'm in Chicago doesn't matter one whit. I can access it just as easily because I happen to know those websites and they're linked to them, and I can access them just as easily because we have that neutral internet. So, but I mean, in under a neutral, non-neutral framework, okay, great. It'll be you want our international news tier. Well, that depends on whether the country has most favored nation status. So if it does, then that'll be only $30 a month. If it doesn't, that could be $50 or $100. Or, oh, I'm sorry, the State Department won't let us do this. Sorry. So, but that's what could be at hand, and that could be what's at stake here. They would be probably gouge your eyeballs as far as the amount of money you would have to pay for this. The services would be apt to be far and far worse. The coverage of what would be not paid for would be degraded to the point where most people would understandably be frustrated on that score. I mean, now it's to the point where if you don't access a website within about 10 seconds, you think something's broken. Well, yeah, maybe something may be broken. The internet service provider may be blocking it, as we've actually seen in the handful of instances of internet service providers getting caught in the act regarding blocking, degrading of service, providing most favored trading status, and so on. Actually, went over these details of the ways they can be net neutrality can be violated at the teach-in we had yesterday.
And those are four levels of violation. One is blocking, one is paid prioritization, one is transparency failures, and what's the fourth one again?
I can remember this myself. It's there's blocking. They're not levels. They're basically four different ways in which net neutrality can be violated. One is outright blocking. One is paid prioritization. You basically we won't stop you, but you have to pay us more.
That's what you just talked about.
Yeah. There's the degrading of service. That's the one we couldn't remember. Right. Where it's, we won't stop you, and we won't have to pay you, but we're going to make it really slow for you to try to access. And then the other is...
And that's what our caller Free was talking about. Mm-hmm. He had trouble accessing, and it's really slow,
assuming that that's what's going on here. I mean, the thing is that we're talking about a suite of technologies, and they all have to work in order for you to be able to access it. And we're talking about the political sphere of big corporate ISPs throwing their weight around to leverage that contact. It may be the case that we may be seeing the beginnings of that. Unfortunately, unless we actually have, you know, a suite of technologies to track that, there's no way to say definitively. So it could have been, I mean, it could be that the case.
It's always within the realm of possibility.
That's very true. And that's actually, and we know because there have been, you know, investigations to follow up on this. That has happened. And in fact, that has served as the grist for actions that have been taken to the FCC to say, look, this is a clear violation of net neutrality. They've been degrading content or downplaying content that they shouldn't have just because they happen to not like it. Well, that's not the issue. You are supposed to serve as that kind of dumb pipe, the neutral connecting framework between a producer of content and its potential consumer or user. That's what you do, and you're supposed to serve as that. Well, unfortunately, if the legal framework is changing where they don't have to abide by that, okay, well, you know, say goodbye to that as a possibility. But that's all the suites that's at play here, and these are the different ways in which net neutrality can be violated. Tim Wu, the guy who coined the term net neutrality, outlines this on a very informative webpage on his website at timwu.org, timwu.org.
One of the things that came to my mind about what you were saying about blocking and all the different violations is that people, two things came to mind. One was, is the FCC the only governing body that regulates the internet and cable? And okay. And then the second thing is, you know, so, you know, maybe, you know, maybe it's not the FCC. Are they the only? Because when I think this is a little personal about me. Mm-hmm. I worked for a public utility. Mm-hmm. I worked for an electric company out west. Mm-hmm. And I worked in the legal department, and we had to do a lot of compliance with a number of federal agencies that regulate nuclear power, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and so on. I mean, just from the SEC to them. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just an alphabet soup. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, the nuclear power industry is highly regulated, and we've seen, you know, and I am going to have people on the air in the not too distant future who are from the Citizens Utility Board talking about electrical rates, a subject that actually is very near and dear to my heart, just as much as net neutrality. Not that you needed to know that TMI, but anyway, and TMI for me as a person who worked in a utility is Three Mile Island, you know. So think about all the different things that corporations, you know, regulating the nuclear power industry, like and how we have to constantly monitor and be aware of that versus how the internet is regulated. Mm-hmm. So I want to speak to that, and then the second thing I wanted to speak to is this idea of the case law and the technicality of net neutrality. I think part of the reason why people are not as they are more inclined to be activist now than they were in the past. Basically, I think because more people are on the internet than were maybe 10 years ago, and that number is increasing. But still, in terms of discussing this at a cocktail party, you know, what can you do to make it more sexy? And how do we, you know, how do we make it? I mean, one of the things that I've decided to do is to say, well, here are the consequences of what will happen. Mm-hmm. And how do you feel about that? And make it more personal. That's one of the strategies that suggests. But how do people put their minds around, you know, the regulation of the internet, why that's important, and whether or not there are other bodies and other ways that we can get active in addition to what you just mentioned?
Yeah. Let's tackle the first question first. Is the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, the only body under which these fights would take place? Historically, the answer has been yes, they are the only body. But we are now finding, and in fact, this has actually now been mentioned just in the last week, there's been discussion within the political community articles and discussions and such, that the answer may be not anymore. We may be seeing other entities, government regulatory agencies, enter into the fray. Two in particular have been mentioned. One, the Federal Trade Commission, because of the importance of the internet playing regarding commerce increasingly in the internet. More so than the proverbial brick and mortar commerce, where, you know, you go to a store and you buy something. Well, increasingly a lot of people are going online and buying something. Well, yeah, shouldn't that be matter? Shouldn't that be regulated? And shouldn't the policies of a net neutral platform? If I want to buy something that isn't illegal, but nonetheless someone is blocking it because of most favored trading status of some sort of the internet, shouldn't that matter, and shouldn't the Federal Trade Commission get involved? Increasingly, we're now seeing discussion just emerging within the last week that the answer might be yes. How this will play out is yet to be seen, but that is now an option, and we may see the FTC actually enter the fray on this score. And that's not insignificant, because if it turns out that the FTC and the FCC don't agree, we may see an opening there where that additional public involvement actually may have a window that actually helped to shape this fight in a positive direction, hopefully toward maintaining a neutral platform. That's not the only avenue. We are now also seeing the beginnings of potential antitrust actions regarding the internet service providers, for whom a net neutral platform and a neutral policy is critical here. As we've seen and has been mentioned before and has been talked about a long time but needs to be born again, markets tend to concentrate. And we've seen a great example of this, or a sad example of this, regarding the internet service provider companies, the cable companies and the telephone providers, were to the point that, at least for as far as telephony is concerned, about maybe 90%, no, what's the number? 62% of the market of telephone access is held by just four companies. In the cable industry, it's something like, no, it's the other way around. 90% and just four companies in telephone. about 62% by just four companies in cable. It's tremendously concentrated. And this is a pattern historically regarding markets, and they tend to concentrate. There's been a lot of books that have been written about this. Two in particular I'll mention. One historical, The Incorporation of America, where they actually talk about the in the effects of corporate consolidation regarding like the America circa 1890 or so. But as far as the more recent instances about this and the impacts regarding the internet, I recommend an excellent book called Digital Disconnect. By Robert McChesney, who actually lives here in Illinois. He's on the faculty at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. And he wrote a book published earlier in the year called Digital Disconnect. There's a chapter in there where he talks at great length about markets and how markets tend to concentrate and how that concentration tends to make things worse as far as the whole proverbial, you know, diverse markets competing with each other, and the invisible hand guides them toward a beneficial outcome for all participants. That's the theory. The reality is more like what other scholars have termed the proverbial invisible foot, where markets tend to concentrate. They ignore outcomes outside of the immediate consumer and producer, things tend to go to hell in a handbasket. That's where one remedy historically has been antitrust, to break up these monopolies and to basically force them out on this score. That is now, I'm happy to report, also being talked about and might also be an avenue. This is an enormously hard fight to try to fight, especially where these corporations have gotten very good at skirting these laws and basically trying to work around them. Sometimes they don't always succeed. We actually saw a case example just a couple years ago when AT&T, the number two phone provider, tried to buy out the number four provider, T-Mobile, in a deal that a lot of people thought would happen, but which didn't. It actually got blocked by both the Federal Trade Commission and the Federal Communications Commission, both of whom have to grant their approval. Formally, it's not actually a block, but the signals were in the direction of a block. And the corporations read the tea leaves and said, we're not going to get this done. And so they backed off. But the effect was that of a block. And that's where I think that trying to break up these monopolies, we'll have to break up AT&T again just 30 years after it was broken up in 1983 in a lawsuit that took probably decades to try to materialize. That has been mentioned as an option there. And that's where that is another positive benefit of all of the public involvement on this score, that people are exploring other avenues, even if the FCC drops the ball regarding net neutrality.
We're talking on the subject of regulation. I think mm-hmm. it's also very important to mention that a lot of people on the FCC were Republican nominees, that these are political offices that are sometimes that have partisan background. And could you talk to that a little bit?
Yeah, there is, when a lot of the decisions that were taking place in the early history of the net neutrality fight, we're talking 2002, 2003, 2006, all the way up through to 2009. Yeah, that was under, the rule is at the FCC, the majority of the five commissioners that sit on the FCC are of the political party of what the White House is at the time. So that from 2001 through 2009, you had a Republican in the White House, you're going to have a majority of Republicans at the FCC. And that'll matter because those Republicans can have a disproportionate say, not only regarding their particular policies that they want to try to enact, but also that they'll have the votes to actually carry it out. In 2009, now we have a Democrat in the White House. Therefore, we're going to have a Democratic majority in the FCC. But this, and that will matter in certain respects. I mean, there have been some avenues that actually helped to improve policy options regarding the internet and radio and a whole host of other options that you wouldn't necessarily have under a Republican framework. That said, though, there are, and people justifiably criticize the fact that a lot of Democrats have still go along with that corporate tide. And in fact, it is a bipartisan effort where you find, it's sad to say, that a lot of the FCC commissioners, once they leave the FCC, go on to serve in high-powered positions as executives, as lawyers, as lobbyists, and as others for the very corporations, media corporations usually, that they supposedly regulated while at the FCC. The old joke there is that you better be careful who you're going to be talking to at the FCC while you're serving as a commissioner there. You could be talking to your future boss. And that's where this kind of, you know, where the corporations are captured by the very industries they supposedly regulate. This is a classic example. You can find plenty of other examples, but this is unfortunately another sad example of where this is the case. And I have to say, it is a bipartisan effort. You will find examples of folks like Reed Hunt or Julius Ganachowski, another Polish guy, who actually was the chair of the FCC during Barack Obama's first term, and who actually enacted a net neutrality policy that actually didn't require a reclassification and, to no surprise, got destroyed in the courts. Julius Ganachowski wound up leaving the FCC and is now an investor with the Carlyle Group. Folks who might be familiar with that name, my group, it's an investment firm that actually has ties to a lot of old school Republicans, including the a lot of cronies of the first George Bush. And there are a lot of ties there, and that's where he works now. And because he basically served his job as a dutiful corporate regulator within the FCC. So yeah, that's sad to say that has been, and it's not just regarding the internet. There's been like a whole host of instances of Democrats carrying out very bad policies while at the FCC. There are a few diamonds in the rough again of people like Nick Johnson, who served at the FCC in the late 1960s and early 70s, who I met, by the way, Michael Copps, who was a commissioner again during all this time, during the 2001 through actually just retired in 2011. But he served at the FCC for more than a decade, and he was a great champion, one of the very best in what is sad to say a very low hurdle to jump over among commissioners at the FCC. But nonetheless, he was actually interim chair for the better part of a year in the interregnum between when Republicans were switching to Democrats in the transition. Michael Copps served as interim chair there for a time. So yeah, there are some good people who do good work at the FCC. But the avenue and opportunities by which that kind of work can happen is pretty narrow, and is especially narrow when people are basically leaving the FCC to their own devices and the corporations can basically have their disproportionate sway on things. If you have a lot of people weighing in on these issues, as we've seen regarding the net neutrality fight in recent months, our odds improve markedly. No, still no guarantee. We could still things yet disappoint us. But at least the window is there. And that's where we have to do everything we can to keep people involved, to keep the idea on the radar, and to keep the internet as a neutral and fair playing ground. On that point, you had asked a question earlier regarding kind of boring, dull and pretty technical case law that it was basically the back and forth regarding net neutrality from roughly about 2007 until this year for the last 7 years or so. Yeah, that's pretty complicated, and it gets to a lot of details that only a law student could love, but nonetheless are important because those are the details by which the policy are crafted that ultimately lead to you being able to view Netflix with a reasonably fast connection. That may take 3 or 4 years to play out, but nonetheless, it that's where it begins, and that's where getting people involved and interested in the policy back and forth is critical. How do we make it sexy for people to do that? Well, we had mentioned some examples. Others are there. I'm happy to report that a lot of people have been taking to making videos to help to try to make this an understandable issue. The best I've seen has been probably John Oliver, who on his HBO program Last Week Tonight, and you can see videos of this on YouTube, where he talked about it in an excellent 13-minute video where he talks about it and explains it, and it's funny, and it's interesting, and it's engaging. There's another guy who actually, he's from America, but he now lives in England, CPG Gray. He's been quite popular as far as providing cartoon videos where he explains stuff. Like, he'll explain, he has a video called Death to Pennies, where he actually explains and argues against the maintenance of a penny in the United States. Or he explains, the history of the papacy, or the history of England, or why the border between the United States and Canada is shaped like it is. He actually made a video as well, and his videos are immensely popular. They get millions of views. He made a video on net neutrality, where in a summary video of maybe 4 minutes long, he explains it, and he makes it clear, and it's funny, and it's engaging, and it's interesting. And he talks about you interneting on the internet. that has helped to, and you know, he's got an audience of millions, and voila, he helps to make it engagement. Things like that. There are. This is where I think our collective creativity has to come to bear on this, and this is where the proverbial right side of the brain can and should come into play on this, and that's kind of removed from the kind of, you know, wonky discussions and technical jargon, and I'll plead guilty to this too, where I throw terms like, you know, Title II and Section 706 and with abandon, and they're just like, oh God, this again. I want to be interested. This is, you know, this is supposed to be important. Make it at least reasonably interesting.
Yeah, and there is something to be said about the power of numbers and and all of the things that we do to increase awareness of the issue. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, not, you know, you and I have our particular take on this. And of course, it's not only for those of us who have a passionate feel for it. It's those of us who may not know where we stand on the issue and may stand to the opposite end and may say, you know, maybe this isn't such a bad thing. You know, maybe we need to have, you know, some way for people can to get money, for example. I mean, there might be other alternative arguments.
No doubt true. And then that's the thing here. And that's not to talk about this too long, but just to say you're quite right that without that debate, there's no way to know how to stand. And you can't have a debate without the information. That's the grist of the mill. And you can't have that information if they're hiding it for you because they've got a, you know, ulterior motive in mind, which is they want to basically lock in a policy before and make it too hard to change so that you can't change it back or that you're dissuaded from changing it back. That is probably, in a nutshell, my career as a media activist, trying to get people informed about policy decisions before they happen, so that they can stop, with that wider awareness, they can take any and every action they can to stop it on a societal level. Because that's how we win these fights and have won these fights and how our best chance is to continue to win these fights.
Well, Mitchell, I think that is just an absolutely fantastic way to conclude and, you know, draw this session to
a close.
And
that's why radio shows like this are so important and why I'm so grateful for the opportunity to be able to expand on this for so long. Thank you.
And also to have such a passionate and engaged expert on the subject, which can be very dry for some people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but to get to bring that issue and make it more personal to that blue thing, that blue beach ball of death, as I call it, you know, on your screen. But you say the power of numbers, you know, I think you said a million hits on YouTube. These are really important, you know, the 3.4 million comments on FCC, the power of numbers. That's the key to the internet. That's the key to net neutrality, is showing our force of numbers, that there would be, you know, a lot of blowback if there's any, you know, there's resistance to power. And we can resist the powers that be to try to make the internet something that it really wasn't intended to be. After all, it was our taxpayer dollars that funded the growth of the internet. Mm-hmm. And the internet is an extension and outgrowth of all of our collective thinking. Mm-hmm. And we should treat it like any ecosystem with care and respect and excellent stewardship, and not deface it. And like the environment, it's our computer environment that we're working to keep pristine and honest and transparent, like a cool, crisp spring on a hot summer day.
I like the metaphor of a public park.
Yes, our public spaces, indeed.
It is our public spaces, albeit virtual rather than physical, but nonetheless still important. And
you know, and speaking of personal, Mitchell, we did talk a little bit before the show, and I wanted you to share with the listeners for the last 5 minutes of our segment here, before we transition to the next wizard, a little bit about your personal involvement and why this is so. Why do you feel so important? Why is this so important to you personally?
The short answer is because I feel like I was robbed about the opportunity of learning about this stuff growing up. A little bit of background. I'm from Michigan. The week after I graduated from high school, I should actually mention a little bit of background to this because I don't think I've ever actually told this on the radio. I took a high school humanities class that had as its very final project at the end of my senior year in high school, the production of a short movie. I actually submitted the script for that and it wound up getting rejected. But nonetheless, the script that was approved had a movie made about it. And that movie was made to our local public, submitted to our local public access TV station to air. The time I was told that it aired, I actually tuned in. And I didn't see the show, and I actually saw something else. It wound up being just a couple of guys sitting on a couch, basically, the phrase I want to say I can't say on the radio, so I'll say they're talking about stuff in a kind of nonchalant way. A couple other guys just basically barge right in and tell them about a news radio, news TV program that's going to start in the subsequent week with more facts than this program, or for that matter, the NBC News, and they called it Days of Our Lies. And I thought, oh, wow, I like facts. I like watching shows about facts. I think I'll watch. So I noted the time in which they were going to watch. I tuned in the following week. And it was, to put it mildly, I had my mind blown. It turns out that the very first report that they had, it was a news program that kind of talked about the kind of, you know, critical perspectives regarding, you know, society and policy and so forth, writ large. It was a program that ran for about 6 years in Michigan, and I happened to stumble upon, through this lucky break, the very first episode of it. The very first episode happened to have, found its very first report, a talk about the media, mentioning as its key point two key facts. One, the fact that there was an internet, that our media were increasingly becoming concentrated. Fewer and fewer people becoming with more... Fewer and fewer parties, only more and more of our media. And then second fact that they mentioned was how this was going to affect coverage of, you know, what gets covered or what doesn't get covered or what gets promoted or what tends to get downplayed. And it went through the details about this and also the various options that were at play. One of which was, and I this is a big reason I've been a public access television supporter on cable television, CanTV in Chicago, but also, you know, plenty of other providers across the United States. This is a big reason I've been supporting it, because had that platform not been there, I might not have seen this. And we might not be having this discussion, and I might not have been an activist for the better part of, these many years.
And it would have been Pottersville.
That's that's where this involvement gets involved. But it was just like, seeing this report, I felt like, you know, I was just about to go into college, and I felt like, thought of myself as a pretty well-informed individual. But yet, I'd never once heard this. And I thought to myself, why was this kept from me all my life? And so I just felt, I kept watching the show. They actually had it every Wednesday at 9:30 p.m. I still remember the time slot they had. And I kept watching it. I actually later on, a couple years later, getting on that show as a contributor, it turns out. So yeah, during the summer of 1994, you actually can find, and they probably have videotapes about this buried someplace, videotapes of me as an early intrepid reporter relaying stories on Michigan, it turns out. But it was this whole issue about, you know, this whole, I felt like I should have known something about this whole universe regarding our media and the politics behind it that I never did. And this is mightily important, because it was explained, and yeah, it seems like it's mightily important. Whether or not you agree or disagree with it, at least it's the kind of thing we should discuss and consider. And yet it's, you know, for most people, it's still kind of, you know, shrouded in secrecy behind, you know, smoke and mirrors, and pay no attention to the man behind the curtain, to quote another classic movie. But that's the way that these policies are treated, and understandably so, because what goes on behind that proverbial curtain is immensely corrupt. And that's where trying to shine a light on it, to remove the smoke and mirrors, to pull that curtain open, has been the thrust of my activism on the score. I'll mention one other critical point that was instrumental for me getting involved big time as a political activist on media issues. It took place at Loyola University at a conference. The date was November 2nd, 2002. The conference was actually of a group called Chicago Media Watch, not to be confused by Chicago Media Action, but Chicago Media Watch. It was a group that organized a conference on media. And in fact, I, working as a professional software developer, I made the website that actually promoted this. It turns out that, and they're too long to get into now, but long story short, the conference was not as it was built. There was a dramatic change in a, and it actually has to do with the Middle East on Israel-Palestine. A pro-Israeli guy regarding, in fact, the guy who was involved with AIPAC, was actually brought on secretly at the last second on the docket of a panel. And oh boy, did a lot of people lose their collective minds, and understandably so. One good friend of mine who threw a real big fit, and actually a justified fit, got arrested. And asked me to get involved on this issue big time. And so I did. We formed a group that called Chicago Media Action. It was kind of a spinoff. And I thought to myself, well, we'll do what we can. We're a really small group and we don't have any money, but at least we can do some things on this score. In a matter of months, we very quickly outstripped Chicago Media Watch on the score by orders of magnitude and kept it going longer than Chicago Media Watch had. The website chicagomediaaction.org has been a bellwether of this now almost, actually more than 11 years. And that has been where I'm getting involved in it. Oddly enough, this happened right in the cusp of the media ownership rule fight in 2002 and 2003. The first thing we did was to dive in headfirst on this issue and to get involved on this. And we just realized, okay, what do we do? Lots. Write about it. Blog, write a website about it. Email about it. We were very involved early on as far as proving a critical partner in the organizing of a hearing that took place in Chicago where a commissioner came. And that proved critical because that was one of about a dozen official and unofficial hearings that basically where comments were gathered and they were presented in the form and that served the grist of the lawsuit that ultimately stopped the FCC cold. Take all of that away. Go all the way back to 1992 when I graduated from high school and I never see this TV show and all of these actions never happen. That's where I feel the obligation and the duty to carry the torch forward in every way I can now. And it includes every little thing, large and small, I can think of, from writing it to blogging about it to sharing it to getting on the radio and talking about it for 2 hours. This is where this happens. My hope is that some folks there who hear my words, not only on this broadcast, but on redistributions of it, and luckily the internet has provided that framework over it, can carry the torch forward.
Mitchell, I'd like to thank you very much for coming on to WZRD Chicago.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
if you could just say thank you very much for coming on to WZRD Chicago. It was really an honor and a pleasure to have you here, and we'll have you back soon. Don't know when, but I think it'd be kind of interesting.
There'll be plenty of fights to fight. I'm sure there'll be a
occasion. Well, this is so the FCC comment rules, these are going into effect until July 8th.
The docket, just to quickly review, fcc.gov/comments. The docket on the first round of comments continues until July 15th, 2014. A second round of follow-up comments where you can respond to the first round of comments runs from July 15th through September 15th. They'll then formally close the docket. You can still comment. They're not officially counted in, but comment anyway. If you still feel like you're going to get in late, don't worry about it. Those comments will still matter. They have mattered in the past, even after the official deadline. They have more great within the deadline, but still, the more the better. That improves our odds for winning later on. And winning now. And so that's when it's going to, that's the formal docket will close. The FCC ostensibly will take all this into consideration, digest this, propose a policy that they may or may not vote on, depending on how the policy comes out. The expectation is probably by the end of the year. Usually the way these things play out, probably around Christmas. So that's where the window is. It'll probably be in this year. And that could be the last say on this. We may see about whether or not lawsuits may then materialize. The problem is, as we've seen on the history of the net neutrality docket, there aren't a whole lot of avenues for that yet. So what matters now might be the proverbial last stand regarding the internet, which is why the comments now matter so much.
Mitchell, once again, I'd like to thank you for coming on. And we're going to conclude our segment here at WZRD. And we're going to transition to our next wizard, who will be playing lots of music that you can't hear anywhere else. Why? Because we are a freeform station, and we ran a little over. My apologies to my fellow wizard for that. But this is just too important of a subject to ignore, and we want you all to pay attention to it. And we're glad you listened, and it's always an honor and pleasure and privilege to serve you, the greater wizard listening community. And with that, I'm going to end my show with some end this particular segment with some music from Let me see. Who do I have queued up? Some Art Blakey. I said it's going to be a jazz-y kind of day, so here we go.